Rishus, Rosh Hashiva, Rabina, Shlita, and all your fine Rebbeim. Okay, I tell you what I didn't come to do here, and then we'll get on to what I will do. I didn't come to prove to you conclusively that the Torah is true. Nobody can do that. Because it's a mitzvah to believe in the Torah, it's a mitzvah to believe in God. And wherever there's a mitzvah, there has to be free choice. There has to be a way of not believing. Because if somebody could prove to you conclusively that 1 plus 1 equals 2, then there's no free choice. The most I can do is to tell you that if you want to believe, then there is a lot to back up and strengthen that belief and to make it something that most probably is true. But that it definitely, I can prove to you, or anybody can tell you, they can prove to you anything that's a mitzvah to believe is impossible. There's always a room, there's a makom litos. If you want to. The Medrash says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu was dictating the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, so right away in the beginning of Bereishis, they came to a very difficult pasuk. Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmeinu kidmuseinu. Let us make man. Moshe says, I can't write this. Mikana tanosein pischon peh leminim. You're giving an opening to the minim. Some say it's the early Christians who believe in a trinity, who believe in more than one God. Here it says in the plural, na'aseh Adam, let us make man. So the Rabban Shom told Moshe Rabbeinu, so if you write, v'harotze li toshite, and the person who wants to make a mistake will make a mistake. Seems on the surface that the Rabban Shom is not concerned in the fact that he's causing people to make mistakes. Somebody wants to make a mistake, let him make a mistake. So the Bali Musar explained what it means is the following. No one ever became an apikoris from the fact that it says, Nasa Adam B'Tzalmeinu. If you want to believe, then there's a Rashi that says why the Torah said it in the plural. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to teach us that even a great person should ask advice even from a lesser person. If he could ask advice from the angels, then we can ask advice too. That's why it says, Na'aseh, let us, the Rabban Shom speaking to the angels for advice. And it's very clear that that is the pshat. Because in the end of the pasuk it says, Vayas Elohim, in the singular. God made, in the singular. No one ever became an apikoros because it says, Nasa Adam. If you want to believe, there are terutzim, there are ways of understanding it. But harotze litos, person who wants to make a mistake, there are plenty of apikorosim who bring a proof from this pasuk. So it depends what you want. If you want to use your free choice, and choose to believe, there is plenty of proofs and plenty of answers to the questions. If you don't want to believe, all the proofs in the world and all the answers to the questions will mean nothing to you. Just to give you an example, how a person can distort anything he wants to prove his point. I once saw a letter that was written by a goy who thought that he was Mashiach. And he wanted to convince the world that he was Mashiach. Except this was before internet. So he couldn't get on the web and just convince people he was Mashiach. So he decided he's going to write letters to Rabbonim, to priests, to ministers, and convince them that he's Mashiach. And then to ask them that when they're convinced that he's Mashiach, they should convince their congregations. So with one letter, he could reach tens, if not hundreds of people. So I saw this letter. It was sent to a rabbi. This was about 30 years ago, maybe more. He had 10 proofs, conclusive proofs, that he was Mashiach. I don't remember all of them, but I remember the first one. And the other ones were similar. The first one was the following. Conclusive proof that he's Mashiach. It says in Yeshayahu that Mashiach will be l'mala mimalachim. He'll be above kings. She said it's clearly referring to me. Because in the apartment underneath me there are two dogs named King. And that puts me above kings. Harotze litos yitev. A person who wants to make a mistake can bring his proof from anywhere and distort anything. So there is no conclusive proofs to anything in this world that depends on Bechira. So there's a mitzvah to believe and a mitzvah to believe in the Torah, and therefore you have to exercise your free choice. But I can give you at least what makes the Emeskite, what makes the truth of the Torah probable, very probable. And more than that, you can't prove too much anything in this world. Except for the probability, you can't prove 100% who your parents are. You can't even prove that you were here a second ago. Maybe this is all your imagination and you were created a second ago with all the imagination and all the imagination of all the people in this room. So that's possible. You can't prove 100% not like that, but it's probably not like that. So I'm going to show you why, if you want to believe in the Torah, that probably, it's probably true. We have a mitzvah to remember Yitzias Mitzrayim. Yitzias Mitzrayim includes the actual exodus from Egypt, Kriyas Yamsuf, and Matan Torah. That is the packet of Yitzias Mitzrayim. How many times a year are we required to remember Yitzias Mitzrayim? Every day, twice a day. Okay, so that's about 700 times a year. And then add to that, every Shabbos we have another mitzvah, Zichiris Yitzias Mitzrayim. Every Yontif is Zichiris Yitzias Mitzrayim. Many mitzvahs, mezuzah, bechor, and so on, tefillin, are Zichiris Yitzias Mitzrayim. If you add it all together, it comes out to no less than 1,000 times every year. Okay? How feeble-minded did God think we were that if we wouldn't remember Yitzias Mitzrayim 1,000 times a year, we'd forget it? How many times a year do we have to remember Amalek? Once. And that keeps us going for a year. What's more well-known, Yitzias Mitzrayim or Amalek? So if Amalek is enough one time a year, why is Yitzias Mitzrayim 1,000 times a year? Well, the answer is the Kuzri in his preface to his Sefer, Yehuda Levi, says the following. We know that there are major religions in the world. Christians believe what they believe. Muslims believe what they believe. Jews believe what they believe. Are they all the same? We have a tradition. How do I know that Judaism is true? Because my parents told me. If my parents didn't tell me, then somebody of their generation told me, a Rebbe told me. And how did he know? Because somebody from the generation before told him. All the way back to the people who were there. So we have a tradition. How do Christians believe what they believe? Because their parents told them. And if their parents didn't tell them, then some teacher told them. Somebody from the previous generation. How did they know? Because somebody told them from the previous generation. All the way back to the people who were there. Same thing with Muslims. So basically, the only reason I believe what Jews believe, because I was born Jewish. If I had been born Christian, I would believe what Christians believe. If I had been born a Muslim, I'd believe what Muslims believe. So the Chor is all the same. It's just an accident of birth that I happen to believe in what Jews believe. Because all of them have traditions. Is there any difference? Says the Kuzri, there's a tremendous difference. Let's see what the source is. All of them have traditions. I heard from someone who heard from someone all the way back to the people who were there to begin with. What did I hear? Let's see, if I was a Christian, what would I hear? What's the source? What's the foundation of Christianity? Somebody came, at least what they say, may not even be the source actually, but what they say, that's what they say. Somebody came and claimed to be the Son of God. Okay? Did anybody see that God signed on the birth certificate? No. Did they see that God gave out cigars when he was born? No. So he just claimed to be the Son of God. There's no 100% proof at all, right, besides his word, hearsay, that he's the Son of God. That was the foundation of Christianity, the word of one man of what he was. Okay, what else is foundations of Christianity? He died on the cross, and he was resurrected. He came back to life. How many people saw that? So according to the New Testament, a group of his closest disciples saw it, and a group of swooning women, fainting women. That's how the New Testament describes it. Now, his own disciples had a vested interest in saying that he came back, because if he didn't come back, they were out of a job. So therefore, they were very much biased witnesses. The swooning women, not to cast aspersion on the credibility of women, but women who are fainting are not exactly credible. A person can see anything when he's fainting. So that is what the New Testament says was the foundation. Who witnessed these things? Who is there? According to them, it's the word of one man and the word of a small group of biased people who claim to have witnessed the foundations of Christianity. Take it or leave it. Believe them, don't believe them. As it says, you can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, and so maybe he made it up. Maybe he wasn't the Son of God. Maybe these people didn't see his resurrection. Very flimsy foundation. How about Islam? The foundations of Islam are even worse. The entire foundation of the religion of Islam is that Muhammad had a dream in a cave, that the angel Gabriel came to him and revealed to him this new religion called Islam and the Quran. That's it. Nobody videoed the dream. Nobody shared the dream with Muhammad. Maybe he had ate something for supper and had a stomach ache and he had that dream. That's the whole foundation of Islam, the word of one person of what he experienced in a cave one night. Now, if Judaism would be the same thing, in other words, how did Yiddishkeit start? If it would have started like this, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam came to the Jewish people who were settled in Tel Aviv, and they said, you got to hear what happened to us. We were slaves in Egypt, we were backtracking through the Middle East, and the Egyptians caught us, and they put us to work, and then God brought 10 plagues on the Egyptians, and he got us out of there with tremendous miracles, and he split the sea for us, and then he brought us to Har Sinai and gave us the Torah, and believe us, then we'd be the same thing. The word of a few people about what they saw, what they experienced. But that's not what happened. Moshe Rabbeinu did not come to the Jewish people and say, I saw these things, I heard these things. He came and said, you all saw these things. The foundation is something that happened in front of an entire nation. 600,000 able-bodied men from 20 to 60 all witnessed this, plus their wives and children and daughters and sons. All of them. They all were in Mitzrayim. They all saw the Eser Makos. They all went through the Yam, and they all heard the Rabbanu Shalom speak at Har Sinai. So we claim, at least, that our foundation of our tradition starts with something that happened in front of an entire nation, which is very, very hard to falsify, because there are only 4 or 5 possibilities of how we got that tradition. One of them being, it really happened. They're actually, these people witnessed all of this, and they passed it over, you excuse the pun, to the next generation, and the next generation to the next generation, and that's how I know about it. Because I heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who heard it from the people that were there. And since Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim is the foundation of our belief, it's important to remember it every time you turn around. 1,000 times a year, because it hammers in the truth of our tradition, because its foundation is something that happened in front of a multitude of people. However, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe the tradition started differently. Who says it happened like that? So there's only a few different possibilities, and let's see how probable they are. One possibility. It never happened in front of an entire nation. They never saw the 10 plagues. They never saw Kriyas Yamsuf. They never heard the Rabbanu Shalom speak by Har Sinai. Except Moshe Rabbeinu convinced them that they did. Moshe Rabbeinu was a tongue-tied, but very, very erudite, tongue-tied person. And he convinced them that they saw things that they didn't see. And then they were all convinced, and then the whole nation passed it on to their children and their children's children, and that's how we got it. But it all was made up by Moshe Rabbeinu, who convinced the people that they saw it, and then they passed it on as if they saw it. Let's see how probable that is. Possible. Let's see how probable. Imagine if I would have come here tonight, white as a ghost, shaking, I couldn't talk, and I would tell you, look, I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but I want to tell you what happened to me on the way here, driving here. And you may believe me, you may not believe me, but I'm telling you it's true, and you look at me and you see that I'm really serious. So I was driving on the highway, there were no other cars around, and all of a sudden a flying saucer landed in front of my car. Six little green men got out of the flying saucer, started singing Shoshanas Yaakov, dancing around their flying saucer. Took me into the circle, and then said goodbye, sped off in their flying saucer. And I'm still shaking from the experience. You may believe me. You may not believe me. But it's possible that some of you would have doubts in your mind. Maybe it happened. Why in the world would I tell you such a crazy thing? Either I was hallucinating, or maybe it really happened. Could be. What happens, though, if I would have come here tonight and said, do you remember last week I was here? And last week I was sitting here, and you were there, and a flying saucer flew through the door, landed on the table here, six little green men got out, started dancing around us, got back in the flying saucer and took off. Would any of you believe me? Why not? If you would, see me after the shiur, I have something to sell you. Why not? Because I'm telling you, you saw it. You may have doubts if I saw something I didn't see. But if I tell you you saw it, right, unless you're completely out of your mind, you know for sure you didn't see it. There's not even going to be a doubt in your mind. For someone to come, no matter how erudite and convincing Moshe Rabbeinu could have possibly been, to tell them you saw all these things, yeah, there may be a few weak-minded people that say, yeah, I guess if he says we saw it, we saw it. But an entire nation, and not just an entire nation, but Jews. Jews are hard enough to convince them they saw what they did see, let alone what they didn't see. We are a very stubborn people. Rav Shamshon Fohler says that's one of the biggest proofs the Torah is true. Because if it wasn't true, there's no way the Jewish people would have accepted it. We rejected a lot of religions that other people lapped up, including Christianity and Islam. And we rejected it. So if it wasn't true, we wouldn't have accepted it. And in addition, there's another aspect over here. Moshe Rabbeinu did not only convince them that they saw all these things, but he also said there's something that comes along with that. Not only that you have a glorious history now of seeing all these miracles, but there's a Torah packed onto it that says you can't eat this, you can't eat that, you can't think this, you can't think that, you can't do this, you can't do that. You think these people would have been convinced so much that they're willing to do all these things because Moshe Rabbeinu convinced them they saw things that they know they didn't see? Very improbable. So that option is improbable. Okay, maybe that's not what happened. Maybe Moshe Rabbeinu didn't convince them they saw something they didn't see, but they didn't see it, but they made it up. They made it up, a plot. All the people got together, and they decided to foist on their children this false history. They tell their children, you know, we were in Egypt, and we saw all these miracles, and God took us out of there, and He gave us this Torah, and here, believe us, we're your parents. We wouldn't lie to you. And we saw all these miraculous things. Okay, so nobody really saw it. And they know they didn't see it, but they made it up. First of all, if it was just, why'd they do it? Because they wanted to give their children a glorious history and make them feel important. They're a bunch of lowly slaves in Egypt. And now they wanted to tell them, yeah, you were lowly slaves. You come from lowly slaves, but you should know we are very special in God's eyes. He took us out of there. He made all these miracles. He drowned the Egyptians. He spoke to us on Mount Sinai. And here's the Torah that He gave. very improbable. First of all, why in the world would parents make up something and foist on their children laws they know have no meaning at all, because they made them up? That there's no God who told them. Never really happened. Right? They made it up. I'll tell you the truth. If I didn't believe that God told me to put on tefillin every morning, little black boxes on my head and my arm, get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go put these little black boxes on and mumble a lot of words, there's no way in the world that I would do it. I don't understand people don't believe that the Torah is true, right? Yet they put on tefillin and they daven, right? From people who are not religious, but they are traditional. Why in the world would you want to do such a thing? Because somebody 3,000 years ago made this up? So let him do it. Why should I do it? I would never do it in a million years. The only reason I do it is because I really believe that God told me to do it and my eternal status depends on it. Fine, so I do it. But here are parents who know that putting those little black boxes on your head are ridiculous. We made it up. Not eating chametz, not working on Shabbos, fasting on Yom Kippur, and a million other halachas that are not very easy. And they know they made it up, and they're foisting it on their children to do, and knowing that there's no purpose to it. Why would a parent want to do that to their children? And even if there are abusive parents in this world, but an entire nation, and usually people have second thoughts before they die. And they say, you know, I made up these lies, I told my children, they're putting these little black boxes on every 5 o'clock in the morning, right? And I know that there's nothing to it. Why do they have to get up at 5 o'clock? They get up at 10 o'clock and not put the little black boxes on their head. So the parents would call their children to their bedside when they're dying, right? A message that's given on a deathbed is considered 100% upholdable in court because people don't lie then. And tell their kids, listen, you know the black boxes? Forget it, I made up the whole thing. Didn't happen. So the fact that an entire nation would foist a plot, right, make up something like that, and put this on their children, not just a glorious history, but all these laws, very improbable. Okay, so let's say that's not what happened. Nobody convinced these people it happened. Nobody made up a plot. Never happened. But somebody made it up 1,000 years later. And that's what Apikorsim say. Ezra made it up. It was a rainy day. Ezra had nothing better to do. He made up the Torah. Why would he call the people together and told them, I discovered that 1,000 years ago, our ancestors were in Egypt, and all these miraculous things happened, and we have this Torah. Why would Ezra do such a thing? Because the people were in Galus, they were in exile, spirits were very, very low. So he wanted to build up their spirits and give them a glorious heritage that they had that they never heard of. But Ezra made it up. And he also wrote the Torah. And he gave this Torah to the people. Very, very improbable. Why? First of all, like we said, he didn't just give them a glorious heritage, but he tacked on it a Torah, and he told them, you know, in that Torah it says you can't marry non-Jews, and most of them were married to non-Jewish women or men. So you got to get rid of your spouses. Why? Because you telling me that 1,000 years ago this happened and we never heard about it? Doesn't some little Jew in the back going to raise his hand and say, Ezra, if these things really happened to our ancestors 1,000 years ago, how come we never heard about it? And if it never happened, they couldn't have heard about it except from Ezra. Why didn't we hear about it? Why isn't there some vestige of it? How was it forgotten for 1,000 years? Nobody ever mentioned it. Imagine if I would tell you, you all learned American history? I'm going to tell you something you never learned. I'm going to tell you that there was a president between Roosevelt and Truman. His name was Schwartz. He was a Jewish president. And I'll tell you a lot of things about him. Isn't somebody going to raise their hand and question, if he really existed, then how come nobody ever heard of him? How come there's no newspaper articles about him? How come my parents didn't tell me, or my grandparents, that they remember this President Schwartz? How come only you know about it? And that's something only a few generations ago. So to say that Ezra made up the Torah and convinced the people that it was true and gave them all these laws that now they're going to accept, things that are very difficult to do based on what he told them happened 1,000 years ago, very improbable. Okay, so there's another possibility. It happened, but not the way the Torah said. And over 3,000 years or 2,000 years, it got a little exaggerated, meaning the following. Yeah, there was a group of Jews who were working hard over time in Egypt, and they had a sit-down strike, and they finally got out. They ran out one night, and when they were running out, there was a big puddle, and they jumped over the puddle. And then they made up some laws, and over 2,000 years of giving it over, it was like the fisherman who caught a sardine, and by the time it got to the fifth or sixth different party, it was already a whale. Things change. Did you ever play the game telephone in England? Anybody here from England?
Yeah.
Yeah, in England they call it Chinese whispers. I don't know why, but in England do a lot of things I don't know why. But in any case, in America they call it telephone. How does it work? You have a line of people, 10 people in a line. And you whisper something to the first person in line and say, pass it down. Now he whispers it to the second person, the second to the third person. Then you go to the last person in line, number 10, and you say to him, what did you hear? And usually it's totally different than what it started out to be. Because people change it. They didn't get it 100%, and it changed a little bit. The next time it changed a little bit more, until the final message is nothing like the original message you gave over. That's 10 people in a room. Now we're talking about a line of tradition over thousands of years. So who said that Enoch and Ami, it started with something, but every generation like added a little bit, exaggerated a little bit. The first generation said, oh, what do you mean they were working hard and they made a sit-down strike? Nah, that doesn't sound so good. Let's say, you know, they were really slaves and God brought these plagues on them. One plague, two plagues, next generation is 5 plagues, next plague, 10 plagues. And what do you mean they jumped over a puddle? And no, it must have been a bigger thing. It must have been a little canal. And then the next generation says, no, they didn't jump over the canal. They went scuba diving underneath it. Next one said, nah, that doesn't sound so good, right? They built a bridge over it. No, that doesn't sound good. The next generation already said that the sea split, and it was an ocean, not a little puddle, not a canal, and it got changed over history. Maybe. Maybe that's what happened. So we received this tradition that really started with something, but over thousands of years, like the game of telephone, it changed. Why is that improbable? I'll tell you why. Let's imagine the game of telephone with 100 people playing, but not in a straight line. 10 lines of 10 people. And the given is, we know that the message that was given to the first people in line, but that's what's it called, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D, right, there's the lines across, it was the same message. We don't know what it was. But whatever it was the same message that all 10 people in the front heard. And then they passed it back. And now we come to number 10. 10A, 10B, 10C. We asked them, what did you hear? And they all say the same message. Now there's two possibilities. It's exactly the same message that started out, and it didn't change. Or it changed 10 times independently, but the same exact way. Which is more probable? First. Because if it had changed, there should be 10 different versions. At least 6 different versions. But there's only one version. So it's more probable that since we know that the same message was given to the 10 people in the front of the line, and all in the back are saying the same thing, that it probably didn't change, and what they are saying at the end is the same thing that was said to them in the beginning. Because if it had changed, there should be many more versions. There should be 10 versions, 8 versions, 6 versions. But not that it changed 10 times the exact same way. That's less probable. We're talking here about not one line of tradition, but lines of tradition, parents to children, teachers to students, scattered all over, even all over Eretz Yisrael. And if it started out with a puddle and with a bunch of people working overtime and making a sit-down strike, and then it changed over the years, but there are so many lines of tradition, it should have changed 1,000 different ways. There should be 20, 30 different versions of Yetzias Mitzrayim. There never was. Even our the people who don't believe in the Masorah never claim to have a parallel Masorah. They just claim that they don't believe it. Conservative, Reform, the Karoyim, right, who don't believe in the Masorah. They don't say, well, we have another Masorah. Didn't happen like that. They just don't believe in the Masorah. There's a beautiful story that represents this. Used to be there were Karoyim, people who were Jews, but they didn't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, and they claimed to be the authentic Jews. And the regular Yidden claimed to be authentic Jews. These Jews lived under the Muslims, the Caliphs, the Muslims. The Muslims gave Jews in their communities autonomy to take care of their own things, take care of their own affairs. But they only gave autonomy to one group of Jews in a city. So it always was a problem, who is going to get the stamp of approval from the government, from the Muslim government, to be the authentic Jews that have the autonomy, and the other ones are going to have to be under them. So many times they would have debates between a Karoy and a Rav in front of the Caliph, and whoever the Caliph was convinced is the authentic Jew, they would be the ones that had these rights, and the other ones would have to be subjugated to them. So they tell the story of a rabbi and a karoy who came to debate in front of a caliph. And the custom is by the Muslims, you take off your shoes and you enter into the room where the caliph sits without your shoes on. So the karoy took off his shoes and left them in the hall, in the ante room. The rabbi took off his shoes and carried them into the throne room, carrying, holding his shoes. So the Karoy starts to laugh and says to the Caliph, this rabbi claims to be the authentic Jew. Look what a boor he is. He doesn't even know you're supposed to leave your shoes outside, not carry him here and hold him like an idiot in front of you. So the Caliph looks at the rabbi and he says, could you please explain yourself? Why are you standing here holding your shoes? He says, I beg your pardon, but I'll explain to you why I'm holding my shoes. You see, our first prophet, Moshe Rabbeinu, came to a revelation of God by a burning bush. And God told him to take his shoes off, and he left his shoes where he took them off, and he went to speak to God by the burning bush, and when he went back to get his shoes, they were gone. And he searched and searched, and he found out that Karoy stole the shoes. So since then, whenever we are in the close proximity of Karoyim, we hold on to our shoes. The Caliph looks at the Karoy, and he says, what do you got to say to that? He said, that's ridiculous. There were no Karoyim in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. The rabbi said, I think the debate is over. They don't claim to have another tradition. They just deny that there is a tradition. There never was another version. Scuba diving, bridge building, right? Canal, river, sea, sea split. Oh, there are differences in Midrashim and details. But we're talking now about the main thing. Were there 10 plagues? Was there Yetzias Mitzrayim? Was there a Kriyas Yamsu? Was there a Maimon Har Sinai? In that, there's no argument. There's never been another tradition. And if it was changed over the centuries by various lines of tradition, there should be 20, 30, 50 different versions. And there never was. So it's more reasonable that it never changed than it changed 20, 50 times the same exact way. But the question then is, why is that possible? In the game of telephone, it always changes. So why here over thousands of years didn't it change? Why was it maintained? So I'll tell you why. Because the game of telephone is a game, and it's amusing, and there's no repercussions if you change the story. But what would you say in the following? Imagine 100 people walking single file through the Amazon, and they are separated from each other, that they can only communicate with the person in front of them and behind them. Otherwise, everybody else is out of earshot. And they're working single file through the Amazon, and all of a sudden, at one moment, they all sink into the mud and up to their waist. They're stuck now in the mud up to their waist. They can't move. Number one can speak to number two, but to nobody else. Number two can speak to number one and number three, but nobody else. And that's the way they are. And all of a sudden, number one begins to have some kind of seizure, and it looks pretty serious. And if something's not done quickly, he's going to die. And number two sees what's happening to number one. He's close enough to tell him to do something, but he doesn't know what to do. But he knows that number 100 is a doctor. So he calls to number three. I'm going to describe to you exactly what's happening to number one, exactly what he looks like, what the symptoms are. You pass it on to number four, to number five, all the way to number 100, who's the doctor. When the doctor hears what the symptoms, let him pass back what we should do. So the doctor hears and he passes it back, number 99, 98, till it gets to number 2. This is what you should do, and that's what number 2 does for number 1 and saves his life. Do you think in that situation the message is going to change going to the doctor or from the doctor? Think yes? I don't think so. People know that somebody's life depends on it. They're going to be very, very careful to be medayik exactly what I heard and what I'm giving over. Because it's not a game. When it's a game, it's fun. This isn't fun. Somebody's life depends on this. And they really care about number one. If they didn't care about it, it's one thing. But they care about it. So number three is going to listen very carefully to what number two is saying and make sure that he passes it on 100% the way that he heard it. And when he gets to the doctor and the doctor passes it back, people are going to know that somebody's life depends on this. They're going to be very careful to be accurate in what they're passing back. It's not a game. The people who are passing on these traditions believed in it. And they believed that their lives depended on it. Not just their life in this world, but their life for all eternity. And therefore they were very careful. When you learn Gemara, how medayik are they? Omar, Abaya Omar, b'shem this and b'shem that, all the way back. Who exactly said it? And yes, there are machloksin, and there are on details, but in the foundation of things, there's no arguments. So it's more mistabir, it is more probable that it didn't change for two reasons. One is because if it had changed, it would have changed 10 times, 100 times, different versions. And the reason it didn't change is because people didn't consider this a game. They considered it something that really meant something that their lives depended on. So of all the possibilities, that it never happened, but Moshe Rabbeinu convinced them. It never happened, they made up a plot. It never happened and somebody made it up 1,000 years later. It happened, but it was changed over the years. All of those possibilities, as I showed you, are improbable. The most probable is that the reason we have that Mesorah is because it's true. Because that's what happened, and that was passed on. And therefore, since it happened in front of an entire nation, that is something that gives it a tremendous amount of credibility. Again, does it prove 100% the Torah is true? No. Can you prove 100%? No. Because if you could, there would be no mitzvah, and the Rebbe Shem wants you to believe. He wants you to choose to believe. But if you want to believe, do you have what will strengthen your belief and make it most probable? 100%. That's why every day we remember Yetzias Mitzrayim twice a day. That's why over the year we remember it 1,000 times a year, so we'll think and realize that what we're doing, and the Torah that we keep, and all of the traditions that we have, have a very, very firm foundation and firm basis in fact. When the next time you say in Kriya Shema, L'man Tizkru, right, Ani Hashem Elokeichem Asher Hotzeisi Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim, think a little bit about what the significance of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Maimed Har Sinai, and Kriyas Yamsuf. These are the partials. Last week was Yetzias Mitzrayim. This week is Kriyas Yamsuf. Next week is Matan Torah. Realize how that important that is in your everyday life, in making what you do something that you base on something you really, really believe in, because the probability of it being true is very, very strong. Yeah.
When they left Egypt, they were a cult. Technically, they could have lied and gathered a lie, which was very common to have back then with cults.
First of all, cults are not an entire nation. Okay? Secondly, like I said, yeah, they could have made up this story as a cult or whatever, but why would they want to foist on their children all these laws that, and the Torah has a lot of laws that are very difficult to keep, and not only that, but they were the opposite of what the cultural norms were of the time. For instance, in Mitzrayim, it was well accepted to marry your relatives. Incest was an accepted thing. And many Jews were married to their relatives, including Moshe Rabbeinu's father, who was married to his aunt. Right? And which is also from the Torah, before Matan Torah was Mutter. And all these people had to separate from their spouses because they made up this cult. Why would they make up things that were oppressive to them? Adarav, if you want to make up a cult, right? Make up things that are fun. Don't make up things that are really, really oppressive.
After World War One, Hitler convinced everyone that the Jews were the issue, while the Jews were running a lot of beneficial things for them. And yet he went around killing them. So how could he not?
He convinced them that if you will persecute the Jews, then you will take over those beneficial things that they are having. You'll take over their money, their businesses, or whatever. It's easy to convince people that you can take what they created, what they built up, you take it, what's it called? They didn't think that they're destroying the Germany, they thought just the opposite. We're gonna divide the spoils. But there's very few cults where people accept things that are oppressive to them. Right? Doesn't happen. Why in the world would they wanted to make up this thing? I understand they could make up something where they have a glorious history or whatever. But all these prohibitions, all these mitzvahs that are difficult to do, why?
Because God promised them a land, a world to come. They've just been held as slaves, and now they're thrown into the...
True, but again, if they didn't believe God said it, they made it up. So they can make up anything.
Why would Moshe
want to convince them that? Convince them that or of it? God said, you know what? And there were religions like this, Jews, right? God said, go to the bar every night, get drunk, right? Be promiscuous. What's it called? Steal from each other, and you'll get your olam haba. That's a lot easier to convince people to do that than to do what the Torah says. So why would Moshe Rabbeinu convince them of all these things when a lot of them weren't rational things? They weren't things that people thought were right and whatever. In that society, it was completely wrong.
Neither was killing.
No. Killing Jews, if you consider the Jews a danger to you, right? They're your enemy. They're people who are out to destroy you, right? They're like cockroaches that are... convince people to kill people very easily, as long as they think that they're a threat to them. Yeah.
Okay. Why couldn't it have been an evolution of ideas over a period of time, and that at some point in history, somebody like Ezra, not necessarily Ezra, but somebody like Ezra who came and stabilized the idea into one set tradition, and then from that point on, it would have never changed?
Could be. But it's also improv. Again, all these things could have been. Not saying that they couldn't have been. Question is, how probable is it that one person could come, right, and there are many, many different versions, and people believed in that version, and all of a sudden one person comes and says, no, your version is not right. You remember that happening today? Ashkenazim, Sfardim, whatever, and saying, no, that's not the way it was. The guy says, that's what my father did. Right? From now on, everybody's going to only dip potatoes on Pesach. Forget about, you know, no, it's celery, potatoes, whatever. My father dipped potatoes, forget about it, celery is not. I once told people in my shul that when you say Hallel, right, you don't say Eloah, but Eloah. The Patach is before the hay, even though it's under the hay. There's no word Eloha. It's Eloah. Okay? Just like when a Patach is under a ches, at the end of a word, or a hay. And if you want to be Hawaiian, you could say Aloha. But if you want to speak Hebrew, it's Eloah. So I had a Balabos tell me, my father said Aloha, my grandfather said Aloha, right? And you can say what you want, I'm not changing it. So imagine trying to get to solidify in an entire nation what these people got from their tradition, and this tradition, the other tradition, or one person coming along and saying, no, this is the way we're doing it, by Jews, doesn't work like that. Yeah?
Yeah. You said that there was no distortion at all, but we have so many different opinions nowadays. Ashkenazi and Sephardim and all different things.
Right. There is no Ashkenazi Kriyas Yamsuf, Sephardi Kriyas Yamsuf, Taimani Kriyas Yamsuf, Ethiopian Kriyas Yamsuf. We're not, I agree. There are a lot of reasons why in details there can be machlokas, and there can be, it's not distortions, machlokas. Machlokas is that the Torah in those details left it up to a certain degree to people to decide. That's how the Rabbanu Shalom wants decisions to be made. Torah says it. If you have a question, you're not sure about something, so you go to the Sanhedrin and they vote. Don't come to me. Don't send a Navi to ask me. Because lo b'shamayim he. Okay? But that is in the details of halachas or whatever. It's not in the foundations. Nobody ever argued about the foundations of Yiddishkeit. Only in the details. Yeah.
You said that Judaism has many many restrictions and many rules, so obviously it can't be passed down. But as you say, so Islam came from one man. They believe in fasting for 40 days in a row. Their women have to be covered up. They don't believe in promiscuity. So here you can see in this one proof you made, not proof, in this one point you made, that it maybe that there is room for an external influence.
Yes, it's possible, again. But Muhammad never told these people that they witnessed things that would make them do it. Muhammad had another way of spreading his religion, which was very convincing. It went something like this: accept my religion or I'll cut off your head. People found that to be very convincing.
Nowadays that's not so convincing.
Yeah, and but once it became ingrained in the people, so they accepted it. But again, if you trace it back to its source, its source is very, very shaky. On the other hand, if you trace what all we believe in back to its source, the source is very strong. That's the only difference. Could it be that both are made up? 100%. Could be. But if you want to know what is more probable by Islam, it's very easy for somebody to convince people, not easy, but it's easy to believe that somebody can convince people of something that he wanted them to do, and that's all it was. Something that he said. But to convince people that they saw, and that's how it started, is very difficult to do. Yeah.
You mentioned that when Jesus' uprising again, that he was seen by a couple of his disciples and a couple of swooning, whatever it was, the exact words, I don't remember.
Yeah.
But then, so the people, women were fainting and they were seen by a couple of disciples. So when God spoke to the Jews supposedly fainted, and assuming Moses, Aaron, whatever, everyone, those who were close, the only ones who didn't faint. So what's the difference there?
First of all, I don't know if it said the Jews fainted. It says they died, and they had to be resurrected. Okay? If you're dead, you don't know what's going on. Right? It's not that they testified when they were dead. God resurrected them, and they heard the Rabbanu Shalom's voice to begin with, right? 100%. Not being in a state of anything. The entire nation heard the Rabbanu Shalom speak. At least the first two Dibros. So that they heard. After that, right, Porcha Nishmasam. But it's not that they heard it when they were Porcha Nishmasam, they heard it when they were 100% alive, awake.
Okay. But what's to say that if they were to say they didn't faint, and that in reality Moses told them, this is what you actually heard?
Again, that Moshe Rabbeinu could convince people that they heard what they didn't hear, an entire nation of Jews, very improbable. Could be, right? But we're talking now, the Moshe Rabbeinu comes and says, you heard this. I didn't hear that. God was telling us his grocery list or something. I didn't hear that, right? But to convince an entire people is very, very difficult. Okay, I'm going to have to go. I would like to stay here, except I had a fire in my house about 20-something years ago, and every Zion Shvat, we make a Sudas Hodah that nobody was hurt, and they're waiting for me at home to begin the Sudas Hodah.